Okay, once again, we'll start with the introduction.
Okay, I'm Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry, also known ARM, from New York, and I'm here in Front Royal, Virginia, with Jerry Matatix. Please.
I'm Jerry Matatix, director of Biblical Foundations, and the purpose of this tape is for me to basically interview Vin Lewis to have him respond to criticisms that have been made of his apologetic style and his manner. And hopefully at the end of the talk, I'll be sharing, my reactions to his responses. Then, a lot of people, when I told them that you were coming down, we were going to be doing this thing together, they were like, oh, no, don't. What are you wasting your time on that person for? You have gotten a reputation in some circles as being very, too harsh, too hardcore, too alienating. And people have said, really, if you do something with this fellow, you're going to be sort of being tarred with the same brush. Don't associate with him. Why do people have that perception of you? And do you think it's at all justified? Or do they have any grounds for concern? In other words, is that perception their fault, or is it your fault, or is it a mixture of the two, or what? Why do people think that the ARM, All Roads Ministry approach, or the Vinnie Lewis approach to apologetics is dangerous or too hard or too harsh?
Okay, let me make a comment in general about, quote, defending myself, which I seem to do a lot of. I have three positions. One is I'm right, and I know it, definitely. I'm not budging. The other is I'm right, I really think it, but I could be talked out of it, and there's a real possibility of me being wrong. And the third is, yeah, I was wrong, and I don't do that anymore. There were a couple of times, either theologically or some other way, when I made mistakes, people were good enough to call me up and say, hey, listen, you did that. And I said, oh, gee, I've just got to stop that. And I changed immediately. But what I'm saying now is, I believe I'm right, but I could be talked out of it. I believe that one of the problems that people have with me is that in the most common understandable meaning of the word, I'm a nag. I think the thing is that I intentionally try not to let people off the hook. When they say, oh, that's a good thing, I wish I could do that, I say, you can, you should. When people say to me, well, my brother doesn't go to Mass anymore, he's joined a cult, what can I do about it? I said, put him and me in the same room. What they want to hear is pray. Well, what they want to hear is, you're a very good person for even thinking about that. I don't say that. I say, you need more. And I'll tell one, which I think is a very symbolic story of exactly the situation which I run into all the time. I'm outside an abortion clinic with a couple of friends trying to prevent girls from going in to have abortions. A cab driver drives by and rolls down the window and says, well, you guys are against abortion, but certainly you got to be in favor of more birth control. And I said, no. And he said, well, you're joking, right? And I said, no. So I went over to him and I argued with him, and he wasn't really any great challenge. And after a while, I judged him to be not of goodwill. So I sort of had some fun with him and started mocking him, particularly on his educational background, because he claimed he was a smart college student. And I knew more about his major than he did. So I told him, when you become an adult, come back and talk with adults. In the meantime, go play with children. Well, a woman who had never picketed with us before was amazed, I mean, absolutely amazed. And she said, this is the greatest thing I ever saw. She said, I would pay money to hear you talk. And I said, this is wonderful. So I whipped out a catalog and I said, here, buy my stuff and listen to me talk, and then you can turn me off. And she asked a little bit about it, and I said, well, one of the things I try to do is bring people back in the church. Oh, my granddaughter left the church. Oh, interesting. What's your granddaughter in? Oh, Church of Christ or something like that. But she's much happier now, and she's a real Christian. I said, she's not much happier. She's not a real Christian, and she's in severe danger of going to hell. Give me your telephone number. How dare you say that? I said, you and I have an obligation to do something about it. You can get off the hook by just giving me the telephone number. You stand in the judgment seat. You say, turn over to Vin Lewis. You have to do something. No, I don't. You can't make judgments like this. I said, we are very concerned. You have to be concerned. Instead of me just saying I was concerned, because saying we have an obligation. Took the catalog out, ripped it up, says, I never want to see you again, never came back to the picket. So what do? We lost the picketer, and I lost the potential customer. Now, the smarter business thing was, though, I guess, just here, fun, here's the catalog, I hope you enjoy it. But the point was, I didn't let her off the hook. I used the personal pronouns. I don't use the word he and they so much, because I use we and you. I think that's what really bothers people. Now, again, I'm working on the position that I'm right, but could be talked out of it. Mm-hmm. I understand that people say it's personality, but I also understand that at times my personality is offensive. But I also point out, Jerry, to your great credit, mm-hmm. you said, both officially, unofficially, on the record, off the record, love covers a multitude of sins. Look at the motivation. And you've also said, which I think is a totally appropriate thing, why can't you overlook what you don't like and take what's valuable?
Right.
And I say, yeah, it's a good point. Now, I also argue, you said, is it their fault or mine? I do not by any means hold that I'm guiltless of error and guiltless of unintentional offense. And one of the reasons I asked you those questions before on one of the other tapes was not for the purposes of other people. It's for me.
Right.
If I can get things across without compromising the faith, better than for God's sakes, let me do it. And I picked up, I would say, of the 9 or 10 things we went over on that tape, I would say 5 were brand new to me because I'm dead stupid in some areas. I feel I'm very confident in some, and in some I'm not even an idiot savant. I'm just an idiot. So I think I can pick up certain things for you. Okay, but I also feel that in this case I'm right, because I say this all the time, that we Catholics are blanked out on our most significant religious symbol of the crucifix. No one really looks at it. Now, I'm not talking spiritual. I'm not talking about the redemption and salvation and love. What is it? It's a man who, by the activity of the mob, the church, and the state, that is, everybody, institutionally and population-wise, put him on a cross after degrading them to embarrass him and make him suffer because they hated him. You cannot put yourself on a cross. No one can commit crucifixion. It cannot be suicide. You can hang yourself, but you cannot. You drive in one nail, you can't drive in the other. It's that simple. You cannot tie yourself to a cross. So the point is, the cross, which we're all asked to carry, says something. And what it says is, when Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me, what he is saying is, people, there better be somebody out there who's willing to nail you when you get to the point when you put your cross down. If you take up your cross and walk around and everybody just thinks you're on some kind of religious procession or some kind of Halloween thing, what does that mean? Nothing. It's not what Jesus said. So what I say is, it is partially their fault that they reject me, because like Jesus, I am being rejected because I'm bringing truths they don't want to hear. Now, I also totally concede that most people in this country have been very happy to crucify Charles Manson. I would be one of them. Just because you're being crucified doesn't mean you are righteous. I mean, the good thief on the cross says, you know, we deserve this. You know, well, they did deserve it. I mean, his own admission. This guy was going through a religious conversion. He deserved to be on the cross. Mm-hmm. Not everybody who's crucified is evil. But if you do try to be Christ-like, you should expect rejection. And I also think, again, and I did a tape on it, the whole concept of the new chosen people, that we're the new Jews. Not that we're descendants of Abraham and Sarah, but we are the new chosen people. We should understand that. We're the new lights of the world. We're the new people who have the truth by which it goes to the world. Well, one of the things about the old chosen people is they get persecuted all the time. But also, Jesus came, his message was to the old chosen people, the Jews, his relatives. And, you know, his contact with the Gentiles was very few, and he never called the Gentiles into the church. I mean, the centurion with the great faith, he didn't say, come and follow me. He said, in essence, well, go back to your servants. I'm glad I was able to heal them. And wait until Pentecost. And then wait until the vision of Cornelius. Then you people can come in. But first, it's Abraham and Isaac, Abraham and Sarah's descendants. The point is, it was the Jews who put him on the cross. A guy called me from California the other day, and he was discussing something, and he said, it was the most terrifying passage in Scripture. It never dawned on me. When the Jews, the same Jews who would have their throats cut rather than allow an idol in the temple, have their throats cut rather than fight on the Sabbath, said when Jesus was being crucified, we have no king but Caesar. Wow. The point was, they hated Jesus so much, they were willing to throw away the whole Mosaic law. Let the blood be on us and our children. They wanted him dead. Now what I'm saying is, if people like you an awful lot for your personality, that's one thing. But if they like you because of what you're teaching religiously, I think you better reevaluate it. Because if you want to really be Christ-like, you better be rejected by the world. And there was an interesting point which I find very sort of related to this. I think it was the last mayoral election in New York City. And in case you're not aware of New York's politics, New York has a lot of third parties, as they call it. We have Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, then Right to Life, then a bunch of others. A Right to Life party runs on one thing alone, and that is anti-abortion. Most of the times, the conservatives get Right to Life endorsement, and frequently they endorse Republicans. But when the mayoral guy was running, it was either the conservative, I don't remember, or the Right to Lifer who was invited to the debates. Usually they don't invite them to the debates. And a lot of liberals said, I admire this guy's principles. I admire what he stands for. But all he was in his position on abortion. And I remember a commentator saying, don't they understand, it's his position on abortion that makes him right on everything else. It's the cause, not effect. And there's the point. It's the same thing like these people who will say nice things about Mother Teresa and say, but just hope she doesn't bring up abortion and birth control again. I don't want to hear that, you know? And it's like, I really like what the Pope says, unless when he starts talking about alcoholism and materialism. Well, I don't want to hear that because I want my beer and I want my Mercedes. The point I'm making is, I think the Christian message should be rejected by the majority. And that doesn't mean the soft part of the Christian message, because there is the soft part of meek and gentle of heart and come to me, right. You know, you rest. But the doctrinal message, and I point out, in my own defense, that I do one thing, really, quite specifically, and that is doctrinal Catholicism. I don't put out tapes on how to pray the rosary because I'm not good at that. Other people do it much better than I. I don't put out tapes on how to develop devotions to the Blessed Mother. Other people are much better than that. I don't put out tapes on mysticism. Other people are much better than that. They know what they're doing. I don't. I deal with the doctrine, and the doctrine doesn't allow variations and softnesses. So therefore, it confronts people, and then I hit the doctrine with obligation.
Right. So let me try to summarize or you know what we've said thus far. What I hear you saying then, in response to my question, why do people think that you're too harsh? What about these criticisms of you? You know, what do you have to say in response? You're saying, first of all, the offense that I cause is largely flows, not exclusively, but largely flows out of the fact that the doctrine of Catholicism is itself inherently offensive to human wisdom and human respect and so forth. And other apologists may not cause offense because they're watering it down, or they're saying, well, you can believe this if you want, but you don't really have to. In other words, you
know. I'm sorry, I can't correct that. I'm not criticizing other apologists for doctrines. The point I'm making is this. Number one, most apologists, evangelists, seem to me that what they're really doing is they're giving the impression that their message is to Protestants, mine is not.
Right.
People misunderstand me quite a bit. They think that I'm trying to be a converter of Catholic Protestants. I mean, I do that individually, but sort of professionally, I'm not interested in that at all. My mission is the Catholics.
Right.
And the reason I debate is primarily to show people how to do it, and also even to provide some entertainment and amusement. So the point is, if one says Protestants should be converted, that's a fine statement. If another says Catholics have an obligation to do it, that's fine. If a Catholic even says, we have an obligation to do it, that's fine. But if I know your name, call you up and say, you better be doing it, and you better be doing it tomorrow, and tell me what you've done, that's quite different. Because now there's no way to see this collective sense of the church doing it, because I'm dealing with a one-on-one person. And I think that's the real problem, is I get very, very personal, and I don't accept excuses, and I nag. And they don't want to hear that. Because it isn't the doctrines of Catholicism, they don't mind that so much, it's the conclusions of the doctrines of Catholicism which I try to drive home. It's the tenacity. And you're right.
And making them accountable, in other words.
Yes, yes. And pointing out that again, the constant message is fell. So, truth has consequences. So does sloth, so does negligence, so all these other things. I think, again, I'm totally out of style. You're talking about the priest giving sermons. If we hear legitimate priests giving legitimate sermons on sin, it's guaranteed going to be on something sexual or flesh. And usually that means contraception, abortion. I mean, those are the real ones. We actually go away, please. My gosh, he was actually against contraception. We feel fine. But no one talks about sins like sloth. No one talks about sins like envy or avarice. I mean, I think priests are so happy just to get across that you shouldn't be contracepting that they forget those things. And I'm bringing up the things that Catholics don't want to be reminded of. I mean, you get to a real Orthodox Catholic group and you start denouncing contraception and it's preaching to the converted. That's wonderful. And you denounce abortion. That's wonderful. They just want to hear that. But then if you start telling them that they really have to talk to their next door neighbor, they don't want to hear that. And they're saying, wait a minute, I'm not contracepting, I'm anti-abortion, I go to Mass on Sundays, leave me alone.
So a new kind of Phariseeism, in other words.
Yes,
as Jesus,
yes,
yes.
Very good.
Words,
very good.
The danger is the more correct we are on some things, the more complacent we can be in our correctness, and someone coming along, stirring up the waters, is not going to be appreciated.
Exactly.
Do you want to hear more adversarial questions for me, or more sort of I agree with you type questions?
Well, I just think secret gifts for adulation would be fine. No, adversarial questions, of course.
Well, don't say of course, because I want to do both, but I don't know which would be the better order in which to do them.
Do the adversarial first.
Okay. All right. Let me say this, then. Let me be adversarial. Let's just make sure we have enough time on the tape for me to say all the areas I agree with you on. which is the vast majority of them. Suppose I say, now, Ben, even if I agree with you, the danger is, you say, okay, if I preach the truth and people don't really want to hear the truth, I'm going to get rejected anyway. So now it's not incumbent upon me to think about the most loving or courteous way to put something. I mean, without compromising what I'm calling for, should I seek to be as skillful a communicator? Forget it. You know, to heck with it. I'll just say you're a jerk, you're an idiot. In other words, they're going to slam the door in my face anyway. In other words, if somebody assumes a prophetic mantle and says, my job is just to, you know, be the gadfly, stir them up, make them feel uncomfortable, how does anyone avoid the danger of that providing complacency in us? In other words, instead of saying, am I developing my social skills or my communication skills to the point where I'm not being offensive when I don't need to be?
That's a real possibility. I don't deny it. The problem is, how much of a probability does it occur? I don't deny that it can occur. One of the things which I speculate on, pure speculation, because this has been, and again, very quick story. There's a friend and a supporter of mine who lives very close to me, and he describes himself. He's just a steam fitter who's retired, Standard Union guy, and for some reason he seems to become more active a Catholic as he's become older. And now he mentions to me, because he calls me about once a week and we talk for quite a length, he says, I don't understand why people are coming to my doors now when they never did before talking about religion. And I said, you should be reading my stuff, Matt. You're going to get them. And I remembered something Thomas Merton wrote before he went crazy. And it said something to the effect of this, that God gives the souls, the opponents, the souls need. And I sometimes argue that the reason I am assigned those people I'm assigned is because those are the proper ones for me. That's a conflict of two champions. And so what I'm always dealing with is the malicious. I never run into the guy acting in ignorance. I never run into the guy acting in good faith. I always run into the guy who knows exactly what he's talking about and is malicious and is knowledgeable and has chosen to be the guy worthy of denunciation. Now this is, again, just a personal, I wouldn't even say conviction, it's a personal suspicion. That God has done this because I see too much of my pattern of my life being divine and providential that God's done this. I also point out that
why fight fire with fire? Let's say the guy is a jerk and he's calling you a jerk, and those are the only people that God has providentially your paths crossed.
Yeah.
But would there, let me be devil's advocate and say
Protestant advocate.
Okay. Well, same difference. Could there be some advantage actually that you would gain by not returning evil for evil, but saying, you can call me a jerk, you can be closed-minded, and you can be loud, and you can scream at me, but I am going to out-love, out-gentle you. It's the steel fist and the velvet glove. I mean, I'm not going to budge on what I'm saying, that you're wrong, you did wrong, but I am going to say it with a smile on my face, and I'm going to say, you know, I'm afraid you're misguided. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Could that even be kind of a jujitsu move that you could use to further disarm them, maybe even further infuriate them?
The key word is could. Could it? Perhaps. I go by my own experience, and I point out, and I point this out a lot when I talk about myself, that I think my experience is unmatched. I didn't just fall into this, wake up to it one day. I grew into it gradually. And the numbers I kept are somewhere in the number of 635. And for the first roughly two, that's the number of people I've dealt with who are committed non-anti-Catholics, either non or anti, and know what you're talking about. They don't count just somebody who can't remember whatever Lutheran or, you know, an Episcopalian. These are the people who studied, carried the Bible, considered themselves evangelists, etc. And the point I'm making is, for the first roughly 2 years, I tried that approach and got nowhere. By nowhere, I mean I got no conversions, very little satisfaction, and very little concession that things were correct. And as a matter of fact, I remember one criticism I got of me was, why didn't you interrupt this guy in the debate as soon as he brought the Blessed Mother up? And I said, I rebuted him. He says, you rebuted him when it's your turn. I said, I agreed. He says, you don't hold agreements when somebody attacks the Blessed Mother. And I said, yeah, maybe that's a good point. Am I being too weak? The point simply was this. My experience was that when I took the very soft approach, I did not succeed by my definition at all.
Right.
Now, when I stand in front of the judgment seat and I see my whole life, maybe I'll see. But I have to make prudent judgments. And the prudent judgments were I was not getting what I wanted. Okay. That was number one.
But not the very soft approach now. I'm not asking you.
I'm saying softer.
Okay, softer.
I'm simply saying what most people would consider polite, a conversation where you say, I'm sorry, I don't see your point, instead of, hey, listen, I'm not a jerk, don't think I am, you're not putting that over on me. Okay? When I said, I'm sorry, I don't see your point, the guy would go over and over and over again. We spent 25 minutes going over the same point. I'd be politely saying, listen, I really don't see it. Ultimately, I'd realize, you know, after 200 conversations, that the thing was, hey, you're a jerk if you think I'm going to fall for that nonsense. A lot of times that worked. The other way never did. Now, the point is, again, it's my experience for me to generalize to everybody else, not necessarily, but it cannot be excluded. Mm-hmm. And it certainly can't be excluded from my experience. And if, again, I'm holding the basic presumption that God's putting certain people in my path for certain instances, then I say, even if my experience is not the same as yours, it's right for me. Second point was that I think there is a definite time and a place when the harsh approach should be done. I don't think anybody doubts that. There's a time and a place when you call another person a liar or denounce them.
Oh, some people would deny that. Some people would say, oh, that's always wrong.
Okay. I don't feel that anybody can hold that simply because Jesus uses an awful lot of...
That's what I was going to say. If someone did say that, if someone said, I never think you should call anyone a name, how would you refute that?
That Jesus, St. Peter and St. Paul and St. James in their epistles and St. John spent an awful lot of time denouncing people, sometimes by a particular name, sometimes by group, sometimes by race. So, and the words are, again, we stick them in the Bible, so we forget this, but a dog returning to its own vomit to eat it is not a Plymouth image. And we say whited sepulchres and brood of vipers. They mean nothing to us because they're not our idioms, mm-hmm. but they're very, very vulgar things
they're
to
offensive.
Say. They are intentionally offensive.
Okay.
Jesus knew, of course, what he's doing.
But now, again, say, all right, but that's Jesus and the apostles. They're saints. They're inspired by God.
Right.
Who are you to say you've got the right to use the same language they do?
Someone who's called to be Christ-like and a saint. And I have to say that if what they did is, again, and I work this as a general principle, when you have problems figuring out the life of Jesus, look at it as an example for you. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, I can't walk on the water, mm-hmm. and there's certain things I cannot do. But when I look at his behavior, I say Jesus, by definition, could not do wrong. But then again, I also look, let's just drop Jesus and drop that whole concept if you want to. But I look at St. Peter and St. Paul, what they were, I can be, mm-hmm. a canonized saint. Mm-hmm. I think we should all shoot to be canonized saints.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, I say, hey, listen, in one of my books, I put that one of the reasons I'm writing the book is so that this will help with my canonization if I get that far. And I say, I really want to be a saint. I want to have my own day. I want to have churches. I want to be up in heaven and have people pray to me and run over to God and say, I got another favor. And they say, another one. I want to blur out the other St. Vincents. I really, really do. And I'm so pleased to run into somebody else at a debate who said that once. She says, I want to be St. Rose of Connecticut. And I said, she says, is that terrible? I said, I think that's wonderful. I think it's a call to be. You really should want that. And the point I'm trying to make is, therefore, I look at the guys who went before me. And again, I look at a whole lot of saints who had a whole lot of success. One of the classic criticisms against me was, so why don't you follow St. Francis Xavier? You had so much success, and you catch more flies than honey and vinegar. And as someone pointed out to me, he dealt with that he was talking about pagans, not heretics. He says, with heretics, you spit in their face. Mm-hmm. And that's the rest of the quote. But number two, I finally got the book from Thomas A. Nelson Publishers. And I read the thing, The Catholic Controversy, which is St. Francis Xavier's series. And he's constantly calling them nobodies and idiots all the way through. They don't know what they're talking about, what a disgrace that they even read the Psalms. They don't know, blah, 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 this and that. And I also point out that St. Francis Xavier, of course, was a great man. Bases about 80% of his arguments ultimately on the fact that we say the Mass in Latin and always will say the Mass in Latin. And therefore, that's why we're the true church, because we never put it in the vernacular, because that lets heresy sneak in. Now, the point I'm making is people who are advocating St. Francis Xavier, as opposed to me, and say that's the proper way to go, have never read his works. And then I say, that makes you a basically dishonest person. And if you're a basically dishonest person on the one issue that I find important, why should I think that your criticism of me is not malicious when it's not based in any substance at all?
Okay. Here's another criticism. Suppose somebody says, I'll grant all the things you said thus far. Mm-hmm. Jesus talked that way, the apostles talked that way. But back then, in those days, that was the culture. It was expected that you would speak in very strong, harsh, colorful language. That isn't misunderstood today. In other words, it's a whole new idiom, and so you're living in the past if you talk to people that way today. How would you respond to that?
Well, it's funny because I discussed this in the class before, that I saw a talk show not so long ago, and a man and a woman were talking in it about a book she wrote on how men and women communicate differently because when they're boys and girls, they have different relationships and they use language different ways. And the thing that got to me is this man and woman, who seem perfectly normal, heterosexual people, were talking about children as they were something from Mars. Neither one of them said, of course, I was a little boy. When I was a boy and play around, that's exactly the way I use language. And she would say, yes, I was a little girl. I did that. They actually disassociated themselves from human beings. The point I'm making is Jesus knew, definitely, every word that was going to be written down. He knew every word that was going to be preserved. And it was preserved for a reason. And the reason is truly universal. Men and women have not changed since Adam and Eve, with the exception maybe of Jesus and the Blessed Mother. Everybody else has been the same. We all have the same motivation. Things don't change. The cultural aspects do not change the heart of the human being. And if we think that, then we've fallen into this concept that somehow Jesus couldn't anticipate these things. That's why I used to joke about things like that. Why didn't Jesus anticipate the problems that were going to come? Why didn't he raise up Martin Luther in, 35 A.D. after the Roman Catholic Church went to Rome? Well, too bad Jesus, I used to use these arguments for Jesus. Too bad Jesus couldn't foresee the future. He could foresee everything, but he couldn't foresee that his church would become corrupt and put a fail-safe system into it. Why didn't he do that? Wasn't he God? Well, you destroyed the divinity of Jesus. If Jesus is divine, he knew I would read these words in the late 80s and the early 90s, and he knew they would have a meaning for me. I mean, he knew that when he was on the cross. And so therefore I say, no, absolutely not. None of that is culturally relevant. It's completely universal. They have to be. That's my answer.
All right. Here's the real... I don't know what order I'm picking these out of.
Okay.
Sure. Here would be the really nasty kind of ad hominem criticism,
right,
of you to say, okay, I grant all the things you've said, but is that your real motivation, Ben? How do I know you're not just sort of venting your spleen? You're just a man who was, maybe you were really berated as a child, verbally abused, and you just want to lash back at people. You're not doing this out of love for them at all. You just get some kind of kick out of verbally abusing people, calling them names, and so on and so forth. And so your motivation is purely carnal. It's purely fleshly. You're being vicious. You're wanting to hurt people. You want to hurt their feelings, and that's why you do this.
My motivation is not purely carnal. My motivation is partially carnal. I don't think I've ever denied to anyone that I enjoy what I do, and I do it for fun. Not sometimes, I have to admit, I'm not sure exactly which comes highest in the priority. But as I've said many times, I think the wisest saints were those who took their vices, transformed it into a corresponding virtue, and rode that to heaven. My vice is this concept, similar to yours. I want knowledge. I've got this burning desire for knowledge. I want to know more. I want to be able to watch Jeopardy and answer every question before they get it out. That's perfection to me. That's heaven. I know more than everybody else. Then I thought about that. That can lead to pride. Okay, I always want to be right. That can lead to pride. However, can I find a corresponding virtue? Yes, I can. I can be right in those areas in which you're obligated to be right, in which defending the faith, in which denouncing another person, in which beating another person in intellectual combat is allowable. What are they? Apologetics and evangelism. So what I did was take what I think was a vice, turn it into a virtue, and I enjoy it. There's no two ways about it. I've said it all the time. I've said many times that I hope people who listen to my tapes are entertained by them. And it's just so entertaining. Yeah, I hope you find it fun. I hope you find it amusing. What, a religious discussion? Sure. What's wrong with that? I don't see anything wrong with it. And that is one of my motivations. And I come straight out and say it. Another motivation is to me the intellectual concept of charity. I'm not a very warm person. I know that. So therefore, it's difficult for me to really like other people. It really is. I don't like most people. I don't really feel for them. So what I do is I force myself intellectually, like when I pick up a hippie hitchhiker who I don't want to pick up, I say, that's Jesus. I have to think of him in the terms of the Good Samaritan. And I think, and I argue, that is a higher virtue than other people who like other people. You good people really don't understand what virtue is. It takes someone like me to understand what virtue is, because I don't ever want to do it, okay? So I have to really force myself. I often think women probably, they have problems this way. They feed the hungry and clothe the naked naturally. They sort of like it. Me, I don't like it at all. I have to keep making these endless decisions. So again, it's an intellectual exercise of the virtue of charity, because I have difficulty exercising it as a warm person. And I think that nobody can attack me for saying, well, gee whiz, those are selfish motives. Of course they're selfish motives. I concede the point immediately. And I don't think there's any psychological impediments in me. I'm a pretty good child. I enjoyed my childhood and stuff like that. But even if I didn't, so what? You wouldn't believe me. I concede, I would say, to the validity, but not the substance of the criticisms. They're perfectly correct. I enjoy what I do. I think other people should enjoy it. I have fun when I do it, and I try to do it in a virtuous way.
Okay, what about the criticism that would say, this is actually a help to you, because you get to sort of make an apologia against all the things that people say behind your back and
right,
you.
Yeah.
What about the people who would say, But you're always talking about yourself. You're always saying, you know, I'm the best. You know, no one's doing it as well as I do. Even if that's true, then, what doesn't the Bible say, let another praise you and not you yourself, and not your own methods? Or how do you avoid, where does self-confidence cross the line and trespass into the area of pride? Or how do you save yourself from pride?
I save myself from pride by intentionally making evocative statements like that. Because when people say to me, how dare you say you're the best? And I say, because I believe in God and I let Him use me, how could I be anything other? Now it's hard to say. So what are you claiming? You're one of God's anointed ones? Yes, exactly. Aren't you? What do you think they put on your forehead? A confirmation. It was oil. You were called to be a soldier of Jesus Christ. I try to make it into a theological position of the thing of that the only thing that prevents you from being perfect is sin. If you don't sin, you're the perfect person that God created you. You know, there's no two ways about it. The only thing that makes you imperfect is sin. Therefore, if you submit yourself, which I do by an act of will, because I know I'm not capable enough of doing things on my own, I simply say, God, use me as you will. Take over. You got the tongue. Let's go. It works. And if now, by the same token, if I said, the organization does rather well, the organization is well thought of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I wouldn't get that evocative situation. Mm-hmm. Again, the car that the guy tries to sell and says, quite simply, this is the best car ever made. Well, if you're interested in the best car that's ever made, you will go look at it. Now, you may reject it. You may say it's a fraudulent, but you certainly won't pick the Ford Pinto, which nobody has ever said is the best car ever made. Now, you say, well, shouldn't somebody else be saying it? Yes, but notice the original trap we're in. The original trap we're in is because I have approached clergymen and bishops and priests and say, my gosh, I'm doing God's work, you better support me. And as I remember when I tried to discuss with one priest, my first words out of my mouth were, Father, do you do evangelization? He says, I do it by my life. I said, do you do it door to door? He says, no. And I said, why not? And he said, I don't have the time. I said, Father, I have the time. Just give me the endorsement. Well, that put the thing on the wrong conversation. And another time, when friends of mine tried to get a room in a midtown Manhattan church, and the priest was coming close, and some enemies of mine ran up and said, don't touch him. And I called that priest, and I said, Father, if I understand you made a rash judgment against me, you didn't talk to me. He said, no, I didn't make a rash judgment at all. I said, well, then, Father, do you know about my organization? He says, no. I said, well, let me explain it to you. He says, no, I'm completely indifferent. And I said, Father, you're not allowed to be indifferent to a fellow man. Let me explain to you. And the phone hung up. Now, what do I do? Well, I expect that all the time. So the point comes down to, who do I seek the endorsements from? I'm not part of the establishment. I don't even know how. I mean, I think at times I've tried to bootlift. It just doesn't work very well with me. I'm not very good at it, you know. I'm not necessarily this totally independent person who really like to defy the world and stand by myself. I just don't know how to get along with others. So I sort of made my vice into a virtue again. If I'm going to stand by myself, I'll stand completely by myself. And then I follow what St. Paul says, be imitators of me. You know, when I was there, I did this and this and this. Be imitators of me. The logic is absolutely inescapable. If St. Paul says be imitators of me, then we have to be imitators of St. Paul, not only in his activity, but as in his invitation. We have to say, the true Christian has to say, you know, I'm doing this, you do it too. And if I said it's simply possible, you can achieve it, I'm not being an imitator of St. Paul, who defended the faith correctly. Again, if you're reading the Acts of the Apostles, St. Paul went around and debated all the time. That's one of the reasons they tried to kill him a lot. They couldn't beat him. When I'm saying, hey, listen, if I can do it, and you people are better than I, boy, you got more virtues than I, you've got to be able to do it too. And if I don't express it in that personal way, I make it so abstract that people will dodge it.
Okay. I can't think of any other sort of mock adversarial questions to ask that I haven't already done. I don't know. We've only got, I think, about 10 minutes of tape left, and I think the summary is going to take some time. So what I'd like to do is summarize the points that we've made, and I think it's very important, not only for the sake of the people that are here, but for the sake of all the people that will listen to the tape, for people to...
Okay, there were two brief points I didn't get across on one of the questions.
Okay, okay. Go ahead.
Why do I take a nasty approach? One was, I told you my personal experience showed it to be more that way. But the second was, as I said, and that's when you interrupted me, if we assume that there are times when there is the proper aggressive approach to take, then you know how to do it. If you want to learn from me, because you've seen it done. And three, up until very recently, everybody else in this field, which seems to be growing, is taking the soft approach. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take the soft approach and you're dissatisfied with it, and there's nobody else showing you how to take the hard, then you've got no alternative to go to. When you go to the Ford dealership, he could sell you the Mustang, the Ford truck, or anything in between. If he didn't sell you trucks, If he was just, say, the Ferrari dealer, which is only a sports car that gobbles gas, that's the only alternative you have. If that's the only car dealer in town, you got to go out of town. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is the soft approach is very common, very widespread. The hard approach should be there, too. And so, therefore, I offer alternatives to people who find their personality similar to mine. God help them. Okay.
Okay. I'd like to sum up by recapping these things, putting them in different words, and in doing so, express my solidarity with you, because I think that would be helpful for people.
You know.
Okay, good. Well, good personal example of the lack of charity approach. But I think what you've said in your defense is that, first of all, you are far from not being charitable. You are being charitable, and that a lot of people today don't really know what charity is. Charity does not mean leaving people in an inadequate state. If they're not evangelizing, saying, well, you know, I'm not going to rock their boat or whatever. Charity means confronting people with their obligations and their responsibilities. I totally agree with you. And I think the single largest reason why you catch a lot of flack is not because you're doing anything wrong. Whatever corrections I would have, whatever disagreements I would have with you, to me are so minor, cosmetic, they're hardly even my worth saying or taking any tape space to say. And they might even be purely personal things that I wouldn't even necessarily say I'm more right than you are. I think, quite simply, you are persecuted because you're doing the right thing. You're doing the will of God. You are confronting people with their moral obligations, and they don't want to hear that. And sometimes the most religious people, like you were saying, that's you were a whole point, I think, in what you were saying about Jesus and the Jews. In other words, he wasn't talking to them, he was talking to the chosen people. And Catholics who are who are made to feel uncomfortable with their lack of complacency are just driven to fury by your approach, because, like a prophet of old, I don't want to put you in their league, but you are the gadfly. You are jabbing at them, and like Jeremiah is saying, you know, you've got to start doing something. You are not obeying God. So you're saying, number one, your approach is charitable. Number two, you're saying that our age is an age which doesn't love confrontation and conflict, but that is absolutely necessary to growth. We cannot grow without conflict. We need to be confronted. Jesus confronted people all the time. Who cares if it's not politically correct? And I agree with you totally on that. We have got to be more confrontational. I think the damning sin of Catholic apologetics today is it does not confront people. It says, here's our case for Catholicism. Aren't we intellectually cogent? And isn't that nice? Thank you very much. Have a nice day. But in other words, we don't want to risk the person being enraged at what we have to say. And we can avoid that risk by simply leaving it at the intellectual level. But the moment we say, what are you going to do now? Do you understand what I've said? If you still reject it, then you're being dishonest. You've got to repent. We don't want that. We don't want that through. We want to go out with the trophy or the blue ribbon, or saying, you know, hey, he was a nice guy. We don't want to risk our nice guy status. And you're saying we've got to be willing to give that up for Christ. They didn't say, as they were nailing Jesus to the cross, what a nice guy. This is what we do for nice guys. They don't do that to nice guys. And we shouldn't make being Mr. Nice Guy our primary objective. It should be to be faithful to Christ. What you were saying about the humility is just because you're saying, look, I'm good or I'm the best, that could simply be honesty. It's not necessarily a lack of humility. I need to say to Vin's credit that I've heard all along, ever since I heard about Vinny, before I even heard him, people always saying he's arrogant, he's cocksure, he's proud. I don't hear in you a proud man at all. And again, I could be wrong. Maybe you've totally duped or seduced me. But you, to me, seem a very humble person for several reasons. Number one, you're always open to correction. I mean, you're always saying, hey, if I'm wrong in this, show me, and I'm willing to change. And a lot of people don't say that. And I think the people you get problems with, they're the proud ones. They're not willing to change. You're willing to change, and I say that to you to your great credit. And I think that shows a real humility. Also, you are really willing to put yourself out for people. I know a lot of apologists who would say, hey, you know, it's after 5 o'clock, I'm not going to answer the phone or whatever. And what really impresses me about you, and I think people should know it, is that you really believe this. It's not a 9-to-5 thing. It's not, hey, we'll live in an honorarium, forget it, I'm not interested. You say, I will drive 1,000 miles to talk to your, you know, cousin Fred and stay up for 10 hours trying to talk him out of this, because he's going to go to hell. I mean, that is real charity in action. And people should judge charity by those kinds of things, not by did he use the right and the elegant language and so forth. You're saying that we've got to make this moral imperative. We've got to lay it on the line and command people to repent. Give them something to do, not just something to believe, but something to do. And when we do, we're gonna get a reaction from them. And the last thing that I wanted to comment is, you said you're not part of the establishment. And I say, at this point, the establishment is going to hell, so amen. I mean, who cares whether you... I mean, now I'm starting to even worry. I mean, I have three letters of endorsement by bishops. I'm really wondering at this point, if I take the more hardcore approach, which I'm more comfortable with now, whether I'll get any more, whether they'll write me and say, don't use mine anymore. So at this point, it really doesn't matter. In other words, the ultimate commendation is, what is Jesus going to say about us on the judgment day? And if we simply say, let's be the guy that everyone endorses and everyone says, oh, he's a fine fellow, you know, he'll never hear anything offensive from him, those commendations probably aren't worth anything, because those people are not willing to rock the boat. So it's a time of crisis. It's a time of urgency. It's a time to be prophetic. We're all called to be prophets. Nothing arrogant about that. Every one of us is called to be a prophet, a priest, and a king at some minimal level because of our baptism. And that means that we've got to be willing to catch flack. We've got to be willing to alienate people. We're going to offend people. That's what Jesus did. That's what the apostles did. If we're going to be faithful to them, we've got to do it. The only two places, and I'll just mention them to be absolutely complete so no one can say, well, did you have anything you didn't say? There's only two ways that I see that I disagree with you, and it's not in content at all. I totally agree with your content. Difference of style. Number one, when I hear you speak, as you did yesterday, sometimes you start out by assuming that maybe these people won't listen to me. And I would say, always start out with a giving them the benefit of the doubt that maybe they're listening in good faith. Maybe they will agree with me. Maybe I don't need to scold. In other words, don't start out with a scolding. Say, we ought to evangelize. And if the people are like, well, you know, they're raising, you know, now get some reaction. I don't think I need to, Vin. Then you come down on them. In other words, save your strongest words for the end, not the beginning. Because if you do it at the beginning, then the storm breaks and then people are... you'll actually be stronger. I'm not asking you to water down. I'm asking you to be stronger. And you'll be stronger if you leave that at the end. But the words ringing in their ears is, if you don't do this, how do you know you'll go to heaven? Wow, that's a powerful way to end. So I would say that. I would also say, secondly, that without compromising the content, sometimes a choice of words can actually get your arrow to penetrate more deeply in their heart. Again, I'm not saying, oh, don't penetrate their heart. Penetrate their heart. But if you say, that's a stupid thing, they can deflect that. They can say, well, we don't tell people that that's a stupid thing, so boiling it bounces off. But if you say, you're not really being very intelligent, are you? Somehow that's a little more socially acceptable, but actually I think it could penetrate deeper. And I hear myself maybe slightly different from you in the words that I use. I try to use those words. I don't know if it's better or not, but rather than saying that's you're stupid or you're a jerk, I would say, you're not really being intellectually honest, or you're not. There's a more kind of classy way of putting it. And sometimes the classier way might actually be even more effective. But those are so minute, I don't even think I should have spent any time on them. I feel far more comfortably approached than any other apologist that I have ever worked with or ever met. I think you're doing a tremendous job. I think people really ought to respect you. They ought to pray for you. They ought to support you. They ought to follow your leadership. I believe as more people pray for you and so forth, whatever tiny rough edges that you have, that ought to be improved, and charity will grow, and we're all on the way. And see, another reason you're very humble is because you say, look, I'm not a holy person. I've got a long way to go. You admit that. But, you know, you will improve with time. I will improve with time. I hope that you'll pray for me. I hope that I pray for you. But I think it's really been an honor. You've been a tremendous benefit to me and a real example to me in terms of courage and forthrightness, and I just want to pay tribute to you on the tape.
Thank you. Just let me say one thing. It's a small industry, and you people don't understand, and I'm not sure if Gary actually does what it means actually saying that. What he's doing is essentially linking himself to a corpse. He may be committing professional suicide simply in a field in which he has five children and which his money is more important to him. I'm sort of luxurious. I can be poor all the time and then live off my girlfriend and not worry about it. But he can't. And if he associates himself too closely with me, or if this becomes too well known, those endorsements will go nowhere. His honorariums will go down. And it's, you know, he says he compliments me for this. It is far more of an act of moral courage for a man like that to say what he feels. Jerry could have just said, thanks for coming down, Vin. He could have said everything he said. He could have said he agreed with me. He doesn't have to say it on the record. There's no obligation for him to do so. It's a true act of moral courage. And I wish him a compliment.
I don't think I was being courageous. I was just being truthful. I was saying God requires us to stand up for, you know, to befriend the person who... I mean, it's kind of like, remember when Paul was converted, and not that you're the kind, but I am, but Paul was converted, people were kind of suspicious of him, and then Barnabas kind of came and said, hey, I like this guy. You know, that's what people are called to do. That's charity, and I think that I'm doing my duty.
I agree with you.
I'm just doing my duty.
Bill, it's nothing wrong with saying when someone does something right.
I guess you need to put your address on the end of this tape.
Sure. Additional copies of this tape can be obtained by writing ARM 55 Palin Road, Hopewell Junction, New York. It's number 38 on Palin Road, 12533. Thank you for listening. God bless.